You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, as the new Greek finance minister fails to present a new proposal to the Eurozone leaders, we assess if there's still any way left to salvage Athens from this crisis. Plus, Iran extends its nuclear talks once again, and the US intensifies its campaign against IS. Our guests today, John Everard and Shashank Joshi, will tell us their thoughts on the ongoing conflict. Then we turn our focus to China as its stock market continues to stumble. All that plus a look at the 10 years since the 7/7 bombings here in London and how Madrid's new mayor wants to erase former dictator Franco from the city streets. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today on the programme, John Everard and Shashank Joshi. John is a former British diplomat who served in Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Shashank is a senior research fellow of the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome back to Midori House, both of you. Very good to have you with us. Let's start today's programme in, well, Greece once more. It's just been given its final chance to present a reform plan to Eurozone partners. Earlier today, the negotiations had a rather rocky start after the new finance minister, Euclid Tsakalotos, arrived at a meeting with his counterparts without a new proposal. Interesting strategy. Now Athens has until this evening's make or break summit to present a new proposal for a bailout. Shashank, I'll perhaps come to you first of all. Novel strategy. Turn up without a proposal.
Is this a
question of someone who's been handed, you know, the short straw, and it's just the worst gig in international politics right now?
Well, I think the Greeks are fundamentally misreading the situation they're in. I think they think the referendum and the spectacular victory for Syriza gives them this awesome negotiating leverage, such that they can simply turn up with a packet of Revels and some tissues and secure through this awesome democratic leverage the kind of favourable concessions in terms for a bailout and funding and emergency assistance from the ECB that they weren't getting the previous week. And I think everyone else is looking at them, particularly Germans, but a lot of other people too, slightly aghast at this tactic and baffled by the idea that once you've replaced your finance minister, who's ridden off on his motorcycle in style, for a more supposedly more amenable individual who could appeal to European creditors to turn up with nothing. And I think that we are looking at this sort of inexorable slide to Grexit at this point. I just cannot see how anything produced this evening is going to change German attitudes sufficiently.
I'd agree with all of that. And I think, you know, is this cock-up or conspiracy? With the Greeks more and more, I tend towards cock-up. I suspect that what has happened is that the Syriza cabinet has had yet another of its stormy, for which we'd screaming, cabinet meetings with the different factions fighting each other, completely unable internally to coalesce around any kind of position. And they're probably still arguing, trying to work out what they're going to give the Europeans so the Europeans can reject it. This is getting silly.
I'm not surprised. You know, I saw the Guardian piece by Varoufakis yesterday, and it was a sort of long piece that reminded me of a sort of undergraduate lectures I've marked, using the word neoliberal lots of times. And it sort of culminated in the phrase at the bottom saying, the Varoufakis' book, The Great Minotaur, or something like that, is coming out in a few weeks' time. And I thought, this is why there's no negotiating strategy, because a man who was supposed to be crafting one was drafting his book for the previous weeks and has just released it after quitting. There you are.
I have to ask you, if that were an undergraduate essay, would you have passed it?
Yeah, I think low 2-2, given the arguments I saw in there.
It's a damning indictment indeed. So what happens? What's the shape? I mean, John, you understand what goes on to a degree in some of these corridors of power. Are these negotiations fatally undermined then by the sort of amateurism that Shashank's identified there, by the sort of ongoing attitude, and just by the sheer gulf in position between the people who are sat around the table?
I think it's getting to the stage where I hesitate to call this a negotiation. I think that everything that Europe could possibly have put on the table was on the table on June the 25th, the day that Tsipras broke off negotiations. I think that even were the Eurozone negotiating team prepared to put anything more on the table, and there's no indication whatever that they are, they would be blown out of the water by their own governments and their own parliament. This is the end of the road. And I have this sinking feeling that what is going to happen is not a negotiation. expectation that what's going to happen is that at the last minute, the Syriza government is going to pitch up with a bit of paper with lots and lots of crossings out and changes all over it, written in its traditional incomprehensible manner, asking effectively for a massive debt haircut. And the Eurozone finance ministers will simply burst out laughing.
And you don't think, Shashank, I mean, ultimately, it's going to be too scary a prospect. You mentioned Grexit, the dreaded portmanteau word, but is that not going to be simply too frightening for, you know, for Merkel, for people in Brussels, wherever they are in Europe, that this haircut, whatever it is, some sort of I don't know,
last minute
latitude will be discovered?
I think it's desperately frightening. Let's not you know, forget what it would mean. However, there's two things that make it less frightening. One of them is this concerted effort over the past 18 months or so to effectively quarantine Greece and try and put a wall between Greece and its failure from the rest of the Eurozone countries. If this crisis had occurred 18 months ago, well, it did occur previous 18 months ago, and we did see concessions, and that was because that quarantine wasn't in place. I think the second reason is the narrative is shifting. It's the idea that Greece must remain part of the European community of nations, part of the EU, and certainly Germans are talking more and more about emergency humanitarian assistance to Greece. In other words, they are distinguishing conceptually Grexit from a sort of more fundamental breach and trying to say we can rescue the latter while still having the former. And once that breach is being discussed so openly and so brazenly, I think that the prospect of the frightening consequences that would follow just aren't going to be enough to force those concessions.
I think that's absolutely right. I'd add to that I think when the prospect of Grexit was first mooted, it was shocking. But that was some time ago, and people have had time psychologically to adjust to what is now becoming a strong probability rather than just a possibility.
It's normalised.
It's normalised. Moreover, I mean, Grexit, one of the big shock tactics was fear of the unknown. But since the idea has been around, people have been able to work through the likely consequences and analyse where the costs and benefits lie. And I think it's very clear that the Eurozone as a whole has come to the view that a Grexit would be a terrible pity, of course, but that the alternatives are far worse.
Let me just ask you both briefly. It's interesting, Shashank, you made that sort of quarantine metaphor. Do you think that the treatment of Greece from certain of the technocrats, you know, within the EU, has that sort of lapsed into almost a sort of bully boy tactic? Have we seen Greece being bullied by people in the EU? Has that been rather unsavoury, or would you not necessarily go that far?
I'm a little bit sceptical. I mean, that's certainly the Syriza narrative, that little plucky underdog standing up to bullying. And there's sort of moralising about this from creditors that perhaps maybe slightly unwarranted in some circumstances, but it's really worth remembering this is not Merkel versus Athens, as Syriza would like to have you believe, in the way they can then dredge up war reparations and all kinds of other unsavory things. This is a large chunk of the Eurozone, a large chunk of Europe against Greece. You have countries, not just Germany, but also some of the Scandinavian countries, the Slovaks, some of the other Eastern Europeans, and certainly some of those other countries who made very difficult decisions. Portugal, Ireland, Italy and others looking at this, and they also have little sympathy for Greece. So are we all ganging up and bullying Greece, or perhaps is Greece isolated for a pretty sound intellectual reason?
Indeed. I mean, in many ways, Merkel has been almost the soft touch. You know, she's been the one going around saying that Europe must be preserved, the Eurozone has to be maintained, and I really do not want to see a Greek exit. A lot of her analogues in other countries have been saying no such things. They seem to have been frothing at the mouth and saying that Greece really is behaving completely responsibly and cannot be indulged. You mentioned other countries that have made great sacrifices. Absolutely right. I think it's very important to remember that the fourth largest contributor to the Greek bailout fund is Spain. Now, another country with problems. There's 25 billion euros of good Spanish money at stake here. Also, while we're talking numbers, the Greeks probably going to ask for a 30% haircut. That's 100 billion euros. I mean, the sums involved are absolutely staggering. And there's no sign at all that Athens realises just how completely unrealistic its ask is.
A final thought then on this. We've mentioned Angela Merkel a couple of times. What's the internal dialogues, if you like, within, not within Merkel's head, but within the German cabinet, you know, in Berlin? What's the narrative, if you like, that's playing out within, in terms of sort of domestic German politics?
We don't have to guess about that. It's been conducted very, very publicly. Merkel, Schäuble and the various party leaders in Germany have all made very clear and very definite statements about where they stand. And essentially, Merkel, as I've just said, is on the soft side. Schäuble is a tragic figure. Remember, this is the man who was shot by a madman in 1990, been confined to a wheelchair ever since. He's devoted his career to strengthening the Eurozone, strengthening the European ideal, and he ends up with this on his plate. But as a good finance minister, he's being forced to say, Angela, these sums simply do not add up. We cannot do this. And the party leaders have made clear that if Angela Merkel were ever to go to the Bundestag and ask for a third bailout for Greece, she will be blown out of the water. There's no way she's going to get that through.
Well, we're talking about one impossible deal there. Let's move on to another. The nuclear talks between Iran and six major world powers are set to pass another deadline. The US State Department's insisted earlier today that talks were making progress, despite the fact the two sides have been struggling to resolve their many years standoff. It's the second time in a week the talks have been extended. EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini interestingly said that despite the extension, it doesn't mean we're extending our deadline. That's a rather interesting piece of, I don't know if it's rhetorical brinkmanship. What's happened then, Shashank? If she's continued the negotiations but not extended the deadline, what is happening?
Well, let's be very clear. The deadline is, there's two deadlines. One of them is a joint plan of action, which expires. That's been renewed already today. So that's easy. That's just a voluntary bilateral thing. The real deadline breathing down these people's necks is on the American side. It is the prospect of congressional review. And if they don't get this deal submitted to Congress by, I think it's July 9th, although you'll correct me if I'm wrong, the review period doubles from 30 days to 60 days, giving opponents of a deal twice as long to stick spanners in the works at every stage of this. So that's really the concern. However, it is not a hard and fast stopping point, and we've seen now how it's been busted through. I think one of the reasons for that, amongst many reasons, is that on the P5 plus one side, the Western side, they want to show Iran they will not be bullied into last-minute negotiations by this hard deadline, and if necessary, they will prefer to break it and accept the risks of further review than be bullied into last-minute folding on key points such as inspections of military sites. So I think, by and large, it is a good thing if it takes a few more days, although Mogherini is, of course, being very silly. An extension is an extension.
That's right. When it's a deadline, not a deadline. This gets all sort of your angels on the top of a pinhead stuff. The key point is that the negotiations are continuing. Both sides have been very careful to point to progress.
Yes.
I mean, it's quite clear that they are advancing. They're just advancing more slowly than people had hoped. Negotiations tend to do this. And Kerry's simply pointed to continuing areas of disagreement that still have to be ironed through. I think your analysis of the P5 plus one position is absolutely right. I suspect that on the Iranian side, they've tried a certain amount of bluff. I mean, the Iranians do this as a matter of course, but that they really will not want Congress to have double the time to unpick the deal. And I'm not laying money, but I have a hunch that during the day of July the 9th, that miraculously a deal will be struck. Let's see.
Let's move on and talk about another issue dominating people's thoughts, or certainly on Capitol Hill. US President Barack Obama has said the US-led coalition fighting Islamic State is intensifying its campaign in northern Syria, while stressing that an effective partner on the ground is needed to defeat the group. Obama's statement followed some of the heaviest bombing since the strikes began last year, after it had been reported that IS had regained control of the town of Ain Issa from Kurdish-led forces. Shashank, let me turn to you. Obama said, I think, in the same address, that he reminded people of his view that ideologies are not defeated by guns, but they are defeated by better ideologies, by better ideas. Do you think he's provided any sense of the route with which those better ideas will tackle this this ideology?
I'm not sure he has. I'm not sure he has any particularly good answers to this. I think it's a reminder. He should have phrased it more carefully. What he meant is ideologies like those of ISIS are not tackled purely by guns. He, of course, is engaged in a massive open-ended bombing campaign of Iraq and Syria and recognizes that is a crucial part of it. I think his real problem is that his strategy is about co-opting the region's Sunni population in both Iraq and Syria. In Iraq, pivoting it towards the government in Baghdad. In Syria, pulling it away from ISIS and towards the opponents of President Assad. What he hasn't been able to do is persuade Sunnis why he has a better alternative. And he still can't do that because he still has no policy for Syria. He still has no coherent way by which he can is willing to support Syrian rebel groups, aware of the risks of doing so. And in Iraq, he's still supporting a government that is extremely weak on the ground, unable to take back or defend cities like Ramadi. So it's a very nice glib statement, but in practice, he hasn't really offered those Sunnis competing ideas and allegiances that makes it worth their while to defect from ISIS in that sense.
Not only has he not offered that, but wanting partners on the ground is code speak for the people filling those boots will not be Americans. It's a reaffirmation of the no grand intervention policy.
And this is why he's jumped onto the Kurdish bandwagon. The reason we are seeing extremely heavy strikes today is because they're all in Raqqa, in the headquarters of the Islamic State. The reason for that is Kurdish forces are advancing very, very close to Raqqa. Now, this is convenient because the Kurds are the only group who seem to be advancing these days. On the other hand, they're also pushing further and further into Arab areas, incurring the wrath of the local population, of local Arab-dominated rebel groups, and of course of Turkey as well, concerned by this Kurdish advance. So the US strategy here has strong limits. This is a big raid, a big offensive in the last couple of days, but it will only take you so far. The Kurds cannot push all the way down to Damascus or right the way into Raqqa by themselves.
So John, who could or should these other allies be? You mentioned that it might have just been sort of code speak from Obama. You know, practically, in real terms, you know, are there any other options for him?
No good ones. I mean, there are some of the Syrian rebel groups with which he's probably going to feel, shall we say, moderately comfortable. They're just not strong enough, and I don't think they have the military skills to do what Obama hopes is going to happen. So, frankly, he's a bit stuck. The good news, of course, is that Islamic State themselves are in deep trouble. You pointed out they've lost a lot of territory. I think it'll be interesting to see whether this counteroffensive against the Kurds can be maintained. There are big stage whispers going around that they're running short of arms, munitions, basics like food and water in the areas they control, and that bit by bit, revulsion at their atrocities is starting to dry up the supply of young men willing to die for them. There are still young men coming forward, but not in the numbers that there were last year.
I think it's worth just also thinking about, once we think about their arms and ammunition and food, also thinking about their intellectual ammunition, which is what you mentioned at the beginning. What ideas do they offer? I think one of Obama's problems here is that he is negotiating an Iran deal which requires him to reassure and court his traditional Arab Gulf allies quite aggressively and also enlist those allies at the same time in his military campaign against ISIS. These are authoritarian, closed states, many of which sponsor fairly regressive forms of Islam and shut down dissent. ISIS, as problematic as it is, has offered some people in the region, a vehicle for social mobility, a vehicle for sectarian assertiveness against what they see as repressive structures, whereas his allies are offering more and more closed political systems, and they've been getting more closed since the Arab Spring 4 years ago. So where are these brand new reforming ideas coming from? Certainly not from his allies.
So what does Obama do then? If it's not a question where he's not able to sort of shift the narrative as he's tried to do in rhetorical terms, if it comes down to what happens on the ground, where does he turn? What does he do next, John? Is it an impossible question to answer?
No, I don't think it's an impossible question to answer, but I don't think he has any really good proactive policy options. Although one doesn't like to use the C word, I suspect that he is now effectively trying to contain Islamic State. He's worked out that he cannot actually, he doesn't have the boots on the ground to actually go in and destroy them. He's just going to try to halt their advance and hope that eventually they wither and die, rather as Al-Qaeda did. I mean, it's important to remember that not long ago, Al-Qaeda looked as if, you know, it was going to be the great the banner leader for Islamism in the world. That, of course, hasn't turned out to be true.
Do you go along with that, Shashank? Do you think it could be a containment game and then hope
that the
state sort of atrophies behind
its own lines? It's containment plus, because, of course, it's an Iraq-first strategy. So it's containment in Syria, no doubt about that. In Iraq, I think there's still ambitions to go on the offensive eventually, once you've built up the Iraqi security forces, to retake Mosul, to retake Ramadi, and slowly create this sort of reservoir from which you can then push into Syria. Mm-hmm. But we're talking years. And let's not forget, from sort of the very early 90s all the way to 2003, we were engaged, and we, the UK, in a completely open-ended campaign of containment against Saddam Hussein. Mm. It was very difficult. It was militarily costly. It tied down our fast jets in the region for years, over a decade. But it was preferable to what ensued, which is trying to break that containment by an overwhelming strategy of force. I suspect the very same calculus is going on in the White House at the moment, which is to say, as problematic as it is, we sure as hell don't want to see an invasion of Damascus at this time. So containment it is.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests today, John Everard and Shashank Joshi. Up next, China's stocks. A decade since the 7/7 bombings here in London and Madrid's push to erase traces of Franco's dictatorship from its streets. Stay tuned.
It's big, handsome, and we'll spend the whole summer by your side. It's the sun-dappled July-August Quality of Life double issue, and it's waiting for you now. Here's what our editors have lined up.
In culture, we look at media at the heart of the city, visiting those cool cats at New York Magazine, Cadena Ser in Madrid, and Radio Liban in Beirut.
In the design section, we meet the Swedish firm excelling in the growing world of wooden high-rises.
In the edit section, we meet three startups improving city living in Oslo, Paris, and Hong Kong.
The July-August issue is on sale now, or make your life easier with a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the club.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still here, our guests today, John Everard and Shashank Joshi. Next to China, where its stock market keeps tumbling. About 200 companies have suspended trading their shares already, with another 700 or so having applied for a halt. If the market continues at this rate, it could soon cease to function, it almost seems. What's gone wrong exactly, John? And are we wrong to read too much into what we're seeing?
Let me try and ask the second question first. Are we wrong to read too much into it? Possibly not. I mean, this is the kind of thing that causes chain reactions that bring down political structures. I'm not saying that this will, but we're in that kind of territory. Let me get a little bit of background as to how we got to where we are. The Chinese regime, deeply corrupt, in many ways deeply unpopular with the populace, has for a long time relied on continuing improvements in prosperity to justify itself. For a long time it did this by allowing Chinese property prices to rise up into the bubble of all bubbles. That didn't quite burst, but it's been deflating now for a while. And so to keep people feeling good about themselves, the regime deliberately allowed, even encouraged, this massive boom in the stock market, allowing huge purchases on margin, things that would be completely illegal in stock exchanges in most parts of the world, and indeed occasionally using government money to keep pumping the stock markets high. It believed that it wanted to achieve two things. Firstly, as I say, to keep people happy. Second, it was trying to offload shares in state-owned companies as a privatization through the back door. And that, of course, meant keeping the stock market high. But inevitably, a market that grew by over 100% in a year was never going to be sustainable. And on June the 12th, the correction set in. It could have been triggered by any number of things. It happened to be triggered by a fairly technical change in marginal financing announced by the Central Bank of China. And as we know, since then, the value of the Chinese stock market has plummeted by over 30% and is still falling. We were talking about Greece earlier in the programme. I have to say, compared to the numbers involved in this crash, what is going on in Greece is petty cash. So far, China has lost $3 trillion worth of stocks. That is 12 times the entire Greek economy. It's about the size of the British economy, to put in a different perspective.
It's extraordinary numbers. And I wonder, Shashank, what you make of this. I mean, John's painted a very clear picture there. the government in China, usually so good at micromanaging its finances, and it appears to have completely lost the ability.
They're good at manipulating. I'm not necessarily they're so good at micromanaging. I mean, on the one hand, you know, John rightly points out this is a correction, and that can have long-term positive consequences for the Chinese economy if handled appropriately as well. You can't have a permanent bubble which has gone up by 150% in 12 months. That will store up problems. And if the deflation is handled appropriately, that can be stabilizing. But what I find most fascinating about this is how market discipline is something the Communist Party just cannot accept. And it isn't really always very clever at how it handles it. I thought what the most interesting thing was the way they had banned reporters from using the phrases equity disaster and rescue the market. Reporters could literally not report these phrases. And we of course, are familiar with the system of censorship that they operate and how effective that can be. And I love the idea, just by rhetorical manipulation, you can somehow, you know, change financial realities in a way that will solve your problems. The other thing, of course, is by pumping huge amounts of liquidity in and manipulating state-owned companies. I wonder what other problems they're storing up for themselves by this short-sighted response. It's the state-owned companies that have been pumped up and kept some of their value and rebounded in the last few months. Many others have just delisted entirely.
Indeed.
Yes, that's right. A quarter of the market gone. Yes, a lot of rhetoric going on. Also, I mean, completely command economy techniques, telling stockbrokers to buy shares. I mean, traditionally, you tell your stockbroker what to buy. You don't wait for the government to go and do it. Putting out an intervention fund, okay, and putting yet more government money in. But there's no way they can stem this run. I mean, trillions of dollars are beyond the capacity even of the Chinese state. Now, one important point here is that by intervening in this way, the Chinese government has made itself, in the eyes of all these people, a lot of whom have lost their entire life savings, responsible for what happens. If it had held its nerve and just said, this is a market, things go down, that's the way life is, it would now be in a much better position. But it has panicked. And unless it finds some way of backing away from its present position, and there's no sign it can do so, I think there's a real risk that not only will confidence in the stock market collapse, but also by contagion in the banking sector. And a banking crash in China, when a lot of Chinese banking is effectively a pyramid selling scheme, it's completely dishonest, would be a kind of economic tsunami.
It could be. That could be truly catastrophic. We must move on, John. I wanted to ask you both very briefly to reflect on the decade we've had here in London since the 7/7 terrorist attacks. And interestingly, a lot of the narrative at the time and since, people were talking about how it was a day that changed everything. And in some respects, what I find fairly reassuring is that it changed so little. People said at the time that the very next day they were back on the tubes, and you know, luckily it seems we haven't had to encounter anything of that sort to that degree here in the capital since. Shashank, what do you make as you reflect 10 years on? Do you think it changed everything, or is there a reassuring continuity almost in the city?
My dominant sense 10 years on is how well the British state handled it. Overall, mistakes were made, but since that point, only I think there's only been one other Islamist killing on the streets of London, that of Lee Rigby. And that is not because the threat diminished or vanished. It's because the security services, but the government as a whole, and that's really important, produced a coordinated response that controlled the threat, disrupted plots, and did a very, very good job. All the while they were doubling in size. Very difficult for an organization of that sort to double in size and then also to work with the police and other agencies. Other states can look at that and be very, very envious. I think, unfortunately, many of those the sort of days of comfort and complacency are now once again being shattered by the sheer numbers we face from Syria. So we are back in that very, very dangerous situation.
John, what are some of your reflections as a sort of Londoner, you know, a decade on? What do you make? What sort of the things that are informing your view on this?
I think that, yes, the continued normality, the way that the attacks failed to traumatise or terrorise the city, I mean, after the initial trauma, obviously. I agree that the British government response, both immediately after the incident and in the following years, has been exemplary. 8 coordinating centres across the country, very close coordination between the intelligence agencies, the police, and indeed the military, in a way that you don't get in the United States or in most European countries. I remember reading straight after the Charlie Hebdo shooting. Hand-wringing analysis in the French media suggesting that had they tried this in the UK, the murderers would never have got away with it. They'd never have got through to the office. They may well be right.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to end the show briefly by crossing to Madrid and just talking quickly about a decision from the city council to remove all references to the Franco dictatorship. This is Manuela Carmena, the new left-wing mayor, herself an anti-Franco lawyer in the latter years of the regime. It's estimated that almost 170 Madrid streets still carry the names of various dictatorship officials. Shashank, just briefly, because we're rather short of time. Is it that easy? Can you just sort of run through the A to Z and cross out a few streets, or does something more fundamental need to happen?
It was part of the history for 35 years and an intrinsic part of some of the most famous architecture. You could no more remove it than the French could remove every trace of, you know, Napoleonic France. But I think the sentiment is admirable. It was a fascist dictatorship. It was a marred European democracy. And I'm really glad to see European countries even belatedly come face to face with this.
So maybe a little bit of a futile gesture, but an important gesture all the same, John. Do you go along with that?
Important, yes. I'll be fascinated to see whether, in addition to changing the street names, they also take down Franco's Triumphal Arch.
Yes, well, that's what I meant. I think that's probably a step too far.
Yes, I agree.
Well, we'll wait and see, but it's good to have ambitions. Thanks to you both very much indeed. That was John Everard and Shashank Joshi, our guests today here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Henry Rhys-Sheridan and Elena Nikolacheva. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Daniel Giacopelli's playing you some great music up next. Section D's at 1900. The Monocle Daily with Emma and Andrew at 2200. More on the big stories of the day. More on Greece seeking an interim solution. But this show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. Goodbye.